I'm Ray Cash, a community advocate and law student on unceded Algonquin territory at the University of Ottawa.
My name is Kim Pate, and I have the privilege and responsibility of being a senator in unceded, unsurrendered Algonquin Anishinaabeg territory.
And you're listening to Appointed. On this episode of Appointed, we're talking about immigration detention. We speak with an immigration lawyer and an individual who was placed in immigration detention as well. We're also going to discuss CHINA, a case that was recently decided at the Supreme Court that gives refugee claimants the right to challenge their prolonged or indefinite incarceration in new and important ways. But before we get to that, Kim, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, I'm really glad we're able to facilitate this conversation, especially from such a long distance. Kim is in Australia right now, and I'm in Vancouver. So, Kim, what is your experience or connection to issues of immigration detention?
Well, my interest in this has actually come about because of the number of people who, especially during the Fujian crisis back, you know, more than a decade ago now, when some of the folks were coming and the boats were coming off the, actually where you are, off the coast of BC, many of the individuals were being, the men were being housed in a temporary detention, quote unquote, facility at the, at a Navy base. Women and kids were being put in detention. And so my first exposure to immigration detention was actually going in and seeing women who didn't speak any English being put in segregation for not following direct orders in a prison when they didn't understand English. There were a bunch of supporters, protesters from No One Is Illegal, and I'm trying to remember the other groups now. But anyway, people were there to show support and solidarity, and you know, they had bullhorns and were calling out and, you know, trying to give supportive messages. And so women were up at the window waving and and they were ordered to get away from the window. And when they didn't, they were taken to segregation. They were charged with an institutional charge. So my first exposure was some of those groups saying, would I go and see these women in segregation? And, you know, of course, the huge challenges, I had to rely on the women to translate for each other. No confidentiality, no privacy. You don't know for sure if the people, you know, if they actually can trust each other. And so you're putting people in untenable positions. And so that was my first exposure. And then after I was appointed, one of the members of parliament who was very involved in this issue invited me and suggested I start, you know, I was suggesting members of parliament go to prisons. He started suggesting I go to detention centers, and I agreed. So I've gone to a couple with him, and then I've also been asked to work on a few cases where individuals have been subject to detention or have been kept again in prison as part of the immigration hold, either, you know, temporarily, you know, being held there because they're now on parole, but then they get put in detention facilities. So, for instance, in Toronto, the women often go to the Vanier, the jail, the super jail, because that's where the detention beds are, quote unquote. Detention beds sounds, you know, not so bad, but when you know detention beds are actually in cells in a prison, a provincially run prison or jail, then you see the conditions. So you actually see individuals being housed and or detained and jailed, incarcerated, because they either don't have status or they've lost their status or their status has expired. I met a woman who had lived in the country, had quote unquote overstayed her visa, but she'd overstayed her visa and become, you know, was afraid to go back. She had been in an abusive relationship in the country she came from. She was working here, had worked and contributed, paid taxes for over 20 years, had children here. And then when, you know, whether it was computerizing or what, however it became, you know, it became known that she didn't, that she had overstayed her working visa 20 years ago. You think they might have figured it out before. And then she was taken into detention. So she loses her home, she loses her livelihood, and now she may face deportation. I think it's a travesty. We benefit, as global citizens, we benefit from the cheap or the underwaged or unwaged, in some cases, labor of individuals in other countries. And then when their conditions become so egregious that they're fleeing conditions, whether it's because of war or because of economics, poverty, and they're fleeing those conditions, then we close our borders. So we open the borders to the goods that we get cheaper because of that, through, our capitalist and trade systems. But then we reject the individuals who, at whose expense, and whose literally blood, sweat, and tears have gone into the creation of those.
You know, one of the reasons I didn't pursue immigration law in law school, even though I was really interested, was because it felt a bit too close to home for me. My family has a long history of displacement and forced migration. Members of my family have been removed from quote-unquote developed countries or denied access for decades. It's really challenging for me to understand how and why Canadian settlers feel empowered to treat newcomers with such disdain and disrespect, especially considering Canadian history. It really bothers me. But I really do admire my colleagues who practice immigration law and grassroots organizations like No One Is Illegal, where folks are doing their best to secure the safety and security of newcomers to Canada.
Those of us who are the uninvited guests or the uninvited invaders or settlers in this country were initially immigrants. So we were initially here with undocumented folks coming to this country. One of my favorite t-shirts a friend of mine has has protesters with signs saying immigrants go home, coming up to Indigenous people and the Indigenous people saying back to the, clearly white settler folk, when are you leaving? And, the fact that somehow if you've been here, or even if you haven't been here 100 years, that somehow you're entitled to be here more than someone who has come more recently is, I think, an incredibly problematic situation. So,
in May of this year, the Supreme Court of Canada, in a case called Chena, decided refugee claimants have the right to pursue their freedom and release from extended incarceration in front of a Superior Court judge. From your perspective, Kim, why does that make a difference?
Well, I think the decision matters because it is the Supreme Court weighing in and saying we need to ensure that due process extends in these areas as well, and that the Charter applies to all decision making that is made, including for folks who are who some would argue aren't citizens, so shouldn't be protected by those provisions. And I think that's very important to underscore. And I think we need to be having these kinds of cases brought if we're not going to do the right thing, whether it's us as legislators or in terms of certainly the government, and if we're essentially starting to close off options that we have benefited from ourselves, many of us.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to sharing conversations we've been having on this issue with our listeners. I think they help to illuminate why the ways we include or exclude newcomers really doesn't make sense. I think one thing that really stuck with me was the fact that Kimora, the partner of someone who is undocumented that folks will hear from soon, is sorely limited in her ability to live a free and happy life, even though she herself is a Canadian citizen. And so many of her challenges stem from the way that the state treats the man that she loves. I just think these unnecessary distinctions are hard to understand. I hope our listeners reflect on that.
Me too, and I hope they also reflect on the difference between how they are treated as a couple versus all the men who came back after the respective world wars and were, open arms for them to bring their mostly women, war brides, here with no questions asked about whether they would be accepted in the country, and the hypocrisy and the racism, clearly, as well, that these stories generate, I think, is vital. Thank you so much for doing those interviews and meeting with them and ensuring this this is part of this episode.
This past spring, I attended a symposium at Osgoode Hall Law School at York University in Toronto. It was called Detained: From Supporting Prisoners to Abolishing Prisons. One of the presentations I attended was about immigration detention, and that's where I heard Olu N. Kimura's story. Immediately, I was pulled in. Olu was detained in immigration detention for 11 months, and at the time of our recording, he was still technically undocumented. Olu did some incredible organizing inside jail, and Kimura did tireless organizing outside of jail, all so that Olu could be reunited with his family. I was lucky enough to sit down with Olu and Kimura after their panel and started by asking them how they met.
Yeah, we met not far from here. We met in May of 2013, and he was minding his business going home with a friend. I know his friend. And I was outside my townhouse, and I saw the guy walk by, and I was like, hey, you want to come drink with me? Because I love to drink wine. And then this one, he wasn't paying any attention to me. He actually said no, and they were going to the parking garage, and I'm very, very convincing, and I convinced him to come up, and then we spent the night together drinking and just talking about, like, all kinds of different subjects, politicking and all that. And then, yeah, we kind of went from there. He became my good friend. Yeah, he was my friend first, and that was it. And then he loved me. Yeah.
Is that your version
too? He loves.
He loves me. Oh. Yeah.
When they met, Olu wasn't allowed to work, so he was volunteering with community organizations like the Black Coalition for AIDS Prevention and Meals on Wheels, the delivery service for seniors.
So how did you end up in immigration detention?
Immigration detention, huh? My introduction to Canada was the West Detention Center. I came to Canada 2012. See, she's good with numbers. ending of 2012, and from straight from the airport, they took me to the West Detention Center. And I was there from November till February. And I was actually going through the refugee status stuff. And it failed. And I was asked to leave. And I was sent back to Africa. But by then, I was already in a committed relationship to Kimura. And she was pregnant before I got sent back. Now, she gave birth to our son, and I tried to get visas to come over, to come see them, because she was scared of flying with the baby. But the visas were not granted, so we actually tried to relocate the whole family to Mexico. And we're looking for schools out there for the children. And another thing, she didn't want to come to Nigeria because of the political instability and the way of life over there. So we tried all that, and I finally got a visa to go to Mexico. Got to Mexico, but the Mexican officials wouldn't let me into the country because they think that what they said was, oh, my country is going through some political unrest and we're going through the elections for the president and all that stuff. So they can't determine if my cause to be in Mexico was a good cause. I told them my wife is in Mexico actually waiting on me. And another thing they said was, oh, you just coming to Mexico trying to go to the United States. So on getting to Mexico, I was turned around at the border and I was sent back to Africa. And my wife and the baby was in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. So after all of that, I went back to Nigeria. and applied for a couple of more visas to come to Canada to see the family, and it was rejected. Then we got tired of going that route, and I was like, you know what? You go have to fly to Africa. Then she did, spent 2 months with me over there, and left. And depression sets in, and everybody that I know is in the Western Hemisphere. My wife, my children, my mom and dad are in the States. So I'm like, I gotta get out of here because I don't know nobody out there. And I came to Canada.
So Olu finally gets back to Canada. He's undocumented, but he's living with his family. Everything seemed fine until one day their family is ambushed by CBSA and Olu is placed in immigration detention. He will stay there for almost a year.
When you were in jail, it's my understanding that you got involved with some organizing and you organized a hunger strike. Mm-hmm. What was that like?
Organizing is a very hard thing to do on the inside because a lot of guys out in there, they've lost hope. You'll see people there for 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, and convincing them that is the way to go, because we saw no other way of getting out. The detention was indefinite. We didn't have no set time. And we're like, you know what, we need to speak up for ourselves. And with the support of the End Immigration Detention, No One Illegal, and my wife, I was able to actually get a lot of stuff done because I had a lot to lose. I had my whole family to lose, and I didn't care what it comes to after that. That was my last resort, and I made sure that I put it to good use.
So, when Olu describes his detention as indefinite, he is referring to the fact that under Canadian immigration law, migrants and asylum seekers can be detained in Canadian jails indefinitely. Canadian Border Services Agency, or CBSA, detains on average over 7,000 people per year at a cost of about $225 per day. In comparison, Ontario Works provides a single person with a housing subsidy of approximately $384 a month.
Kumar, what was it like for you being separated from your husband with young children?
I think it wasn't good enough. Obviously, it was just difficult, especially since he was in the country. And then at that time, I wasn't even driving, so he was like 3 hours away from where we lived. I saw him twice when he was at Lindsay, because I just couldn't get there. It was hard because I'm a Canadian citizen, and I feel like having a family unit is like a human right. And I was trying to convince the government that, hey, you're kind of abusing me over here, you're stripping me of my rights, this person deserves to be here. And it's like you're talking to deaf ears. No one is listening. No one cares. The only thing they care about is their mandate, which is removal. They just want to remove him from the country, and they don't care who is affected by his removal, or even if he's affected by the removal. They just want to carry out their mandate. So I think anyone in my position would feel, I felt helpless, because it's the government. My challenge was not even with like someone that I can put a face to, that I can talk to face to face, not one person, but the government of Canada and their immigration department. And they don't talk to you like you're a person. They talk to you like you're just a file number. They don't know you, and they don't even care to find out who you are. They're just reading notes on paper. by somebody else who also doesn't know you, and that's what you're fighting against. You're fighting to let them know, hey, by the way, I'm actually a person, this is who I am. So it was really challenging. I remember I would send messages, like email messages or fax messages, or write letters to the director of enforcement of CBSA. I would write him on a weekly basis, and I would write to him and say to him, okay, you know what, this is what's happening this week. What are your reasons this week for continuing to detain my husband? Please respond. I need a response in writing, just so that I could have a communication trail with these people who are just not trying to like hear us out at all. And so that was one of the things that I think started to move him forward. They were annoyed. They were tired of me. They were tired of hearing from me. They were tired of my constant complaining. And then when I got media coverage because of the organizing with No One Is Illegal and End Immigration Network, that's when they started to like really budge, because I was making them look bad publicly. But even then, it was still hard. And even now, it's still a very difficult thing to deal with someone who's non-status in Canada and trying to live like a normal day-to-day life. Yeah, it's really painful.
On the outside, Kimora was pressuring the government, and on the inside, Olu was organizing. Finally, after months of detention with no end in sight, Olu decided to go on a hunger strike. He was on strike for 33 full days. Here's what happened on the 34th day.
The director of enforcement actually came to pay me a visit at Lindsay, and he said he was going to look into my case personally, and told me to stop the hunger strike. I stopped the hunger strike after he said he was going to look into my case. But after that, they moved me from that facility to another facility in Scarborough, and they had me in with the general population.
Olu wasn't comfortable in general population. He didn't want to be transferred to another facility where he didn't know anyone and was far from his fellow organizers. Olu wanted out. He wanted to be released back to his family and his community. Olu asked to be transferred back to the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario. CBSA refused. Kimora and other community allies pushed even harder for Olu's release on the outside, and reporters visited him at the Toronto East Detention Center to share his story. The public started to catch wind of the story, and CBSA caught a whole lot of bad press. Eventually, Olu was transferred back to the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, and later, finally, released. Although Olu is released from detention, he still doesn't have the ability to work or travel like other Canadian residents. I asked him what that's like.
This is what it actually feels like. All you do is just work to provide for your family. Like, no health care. You don't have access to what people normally have access to. And it's like there's a limit to what I can do.
Next, I speak with Jared Well. He was the lawyer who ultimately helped Olu get out of detention and helped me better understand the legal side of immigration detention in Canada. Jared runs a firm called Jared Well and Associates. They are a multilingual firm in downtown Toronto that assists individuals with refugee claims and a wide variety of refugee and immigration-related matters.
Why does the state detain migrants?
That's a hard question. So I think the only way to actually understand immigration control is to think of it as a mechanism of social control and to think of it as an exercise of state sovereignty over the borders. In other words, there's an implicit premise that the government can control who can come in and who can stay. And if you are not lucky enough to have been born here, you are subject to that form of control. human beings have a nasty habit of expressing their autonomy and wanting to do things that governments don't want them to do. And in order to maintain that sovereignty over non-citizens, states use detention to coerce and compel compliance.
So you've worked with folks like Ibrahim and Olu on issues with their ability to move freely in Canada. Can you explain some of the processes by which you're able to have folks released?
Yeah, so there's a mechanism that presents itself to anyone who is in immigration detention. Every 30 days, they are brought before a tribunal that has the authority to release them. So that's kind of option one, and in some cases that's the easiest way to secure release, is to appear before that tribunal and lead evidence and make arguments in favor of release. Obviously that doesn't always work, and there are people who are detained for years on end, and it becomes very clear that they're not going to be released within that system. And that's where habeas corpus has come in for some immigration detainees. With mixed success, have been able to engage the Superior Court's jurisdiction to order people's release when their detention has become unlawful.
So in the panel, you were talking about two different streams of litigation. Mm-hmm. Can you just explain a bit about those two different streams?
Yeah, so there's this sort of attempt at systemic change through the constitutional challenge to the immigration detention system. So that is, you know, there's a litigant there. There's Alvin Brown, a former immigration detainee, but it's not really about him. It's about the system and the fairness of the rules and the sufficiency of the protections that are in place for immigration detainees in general. So that's one stream, and that's ongoing and will probably be ongoing for a long time. And the other is, you know, the hundreds and thousands of immigration detention that happen every year. I and many other people are working with individual detainees to try to secure their releases or to try to improve their conditions of detention.
So the first stream, there's a constitutional challenge that's challenging the immigration scheme as a whole. What are some kind of maybe main things that folks are trying to challenge and change?
So the way that I try to explain that case is to say that the problems with the immigration detention scheme come mostly from what the rules don't say rather than from what the rules do say. So, for example, there's no rule that sets a maximum time that somebody can be detained. So the result is that people end up detained indefinitely. And there are no rules whatsoever governing the conditions under which people can be detained. So you have people quite arbitrarily held in the harshest possible conditions, even though there's no actual justification for that in their case. There are also very few rules concerning procedural protections available to detainees, so people end up detained as a result of unfair processes. So those are the sort of the three main things that we're challenging, is the lack of restrictions on how long people can be held and the lack of requirements that they be released at a certain amount of time, the lack of procedural fairness, and the lack of control over the conditions of detention.
So it's my understanding that you work in concert with grassroots organizations like Immigration Detention Network and other organizations and activists. So I'm wondering, what do you see as the role of lawyers in this work?
Technicians. There's not going to be systemic change to immigration policy or immigration detention policy without public support for that change.
According to CBSA, there were over 6,000 people detained in holding centers in 2017 and 2018, up from over 4,000 from the year before. There were over 1,000 detainees that were held in jails last year, compared to 900 in 2016 and 2017. Keep in mind, all of these folks have been charged of no crime. While migrants held in Canadian detention centers and jails have access to food and water, they're not provided amenities like internet access. This further isolates detained migrants from their friends and family and makes it even more difficult for them to locate important resources like legal representation and travel documents. One issue facing migrants that made it to the Supreme Court of Canada is their ability to challenge their indefinite incarceration before a Superior Court judge instead of an immigration tribunal. The Supreme Court found that the tribunal process does not provide the same justice guarantees as a hearing before a Superior Court judge. Next, we speak with Dr. Jamie Liu. She represented Amnesty International as an intervener in this important case.
Jamie, thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Appointed. Today we're talking about immigration detention. So in the past, we've spoken with folks who have experienced detention and folks who are on the inside trying to get folks out of detention. And today we're hoping to chat with you about some of the systemic remedies and ways that we can improve the situation for migrants to Canada moving forward.
Great. Thank you for having me.
We're really lucky to speak with Jamie. Jamie Liu is an associate professor in the University of Ottawa's English Common Law program. She's an expert in immigration, refugee, and citizenship law, as well as administrative law and public law. So Jamie's current research examines the meaning of citizenship, legal barriers for stateless persons to obtain citizenship and nationality, the gendered implications of Canadian law on migrants, and how Canada's immigration and refugee system marginalizes those who are navigating the process. So in May of 2019, the Supreme Court of Canada made it clear in Canada versus China that individuals who are detained under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act now have the ability to seek review of their detention via habeas corpus. So Jamie, you acted as counsel for Amnesty International Canada, who intervened on this case. And I have a few questions I'd like to ask up front just to help folks get a bit more oriented. Is that all right with you?
Yes.
So what does it mean for an organization like Amnesty International to intervene on a case at the Supreme Court?
So to have a case come to the Supreme Court, you need an applicant who has a case that the Supreme Court grants leave to. And as you know, the Supreme Court doesn't grant leave to any case. It grants leave to cases where there is an issue of significant importance to Canadian law and one in which the court feels it needs clarification from the highest court in the land. And when cases get to that level, they're usually surrounding issues of law, around issues that need clarification around different access or interpretation. And interveners are there to help assist the court. They're there not to represent any party that's directly affected by the proceedings, but are there to assist the court in clarifying things that the parties themselves might not think about, implications of how a particular interpretation or application of the law might lead to circumstances or effects that they might not have thought of. And so here in this case, Amnesty International wanted to bring a couple of different perspectives forward. One, you know, Amnesty International, as you know, is an international organization and one that has a very well-known reputation for fighting for the rights of detainees. So they wanted to bring forward the international legal perspective on immigration detention. And secondly, an issue that's close to my heart is issue of statelessness. Mr. China, which not a lot of people realize, was stateless when he was detained. And so for us, it was very important, especially for me, to raise the issue of how immigration detention affects stateless people that may be different from persons who have other kinds of status.
That makes sense. Do you think you could explain what habeas corpus is and why, before this case, individuals locked up in immigration detention didn't have access to it?
Yeah. So I think it's important to understand that when people are detained in the immigration detention system, they are being done so through the authority under the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act, or what's commonly known as IRPA. And so there is a scheme within IRPA that governs the way that people are detained for immigration purposes. And within this scheme, it is expected that people are reviewed periodically as to whether or not they should be kept in detention. There is, you know, a timeline depending on what kind of detainee you are, but typically you see detention reviews happening every 30 days. And during those detention reviews, the Act is very clear that you should lean towards the release of a person if at all possible. And the Act outlines specific requirements as to why or when someone is detained and under what grounds you can release a person or what reasons that may be the case. So it's a very rigid and laid out scheme that's in the IRPA. Habeas corpus is a human right. It is one that's found in our Constitution, and it is outside of the Immigration and Refugee Protection Act. It is not governed by the IRPA and therefore is a remedy that is outside of the IRPA. Habeas corpus is one of the oldest remedies or writs out there. It was, you know, created at a time where kings and queens still, you know, monarchs really made law. And it was meant to, you know, prevent the detention of persons unlawfully, that people couldn't just be put into prisons or other kinds of confinement without a legal reason. And so it is a very old writ and very old remedy, but one that is fundamental to the values that we have as a democracy in protecting liberty and the security of the person, all these values that are found in the Constitution. Having said this, you know, there was a case in the 80s where this issue kind of came to the courts tangentially, where if there was a scheme created by the legislature, i.e. through legislation, that allowed for the review of detention, would habeas corpus still be available to such persons? And you would have seen, you know, through a lot of jurisprudence that talks about immigration detention in the lower courts, talk about the Peru case, or what was famously called the Peru exception. And Peru was a case that was heard at the Supreme Court in 1994. And there the court said that, listen, we will apply this exception where habeas corpus will not be available if there is a comprehensive scheme put in place in the legislation that effectively provides a habeas corpus type remedy. So since then, every time somebody wanted to raise the issue of habeas corpus or raise an issue in a court that is not within the scheme of the IRPA or within an administrative venue, for that matter, looking for common law remedies within an administrative tribunal, the government always argued that the Peru exception applied, that people who were governed by immigration detention were governed by a scheme that was created in legislation, and therefore habeas corpus was not available. So this case really brings to fore this issue again. Here, I think it's really interesting that this issue has come after so many decades, and despite the fact that many people could have benefited from this kind of clarification earlier, but nevertheless, the court has, you know, made a decision in China that is useful in many respects.
So you say that the decision is useful. Do you think you can say more about how the effects of China, I guess you don't know the future, but if you could predict, how do you think the effects of China will play out in practice?
Yeah, so I have two views that are opposite with regards to China. I think it is an amazing decision and that it is important in that it pronounces a strong confirmation that immigration detainees have the right to habeas corpus. The court recognized that the scheme within the IRPA was not rigorous enough, was not comprehensive to throw away the access to habeas corpus. And so that is really important because it means now that people who are not able to get the kind of relief that they expect to under the scheme in the IRPA by going through these detention reviews governed by the Immigration Division of the Immigration and Refugee Board, they can go outside of that scheme and approach a provincial court and ask for habeas corpus. So this is important in the sense that it allows immigration detainees access to a completely different venue. And I think it's really important to recognize this in the context of which immigration detention exists in Canada. And so many of your listeners may be aware that the Immigration and Refugee Board had conducted an external audit of the immigration detention review system. And the audit was scathing. It was undeniably one of the most important pieces that came out of the board, I would say, in terms of systemic recognition of the way in which people are being held in immigration detention. And the audit, identified issues with the way in which people were able to give evidence. Some detainees were not able to testify on their own behalf, provide access for their witnesses to testify upon. They were not able to present certain kinds of evidence. Some of them did not have access to a lawyer, and very problematic decisions were being issued with reasons that would not stand up to procedural fairness. And so some of your listeners may ask, well, you know, that is an administrative decision. Why couldn't you get those decisions judicially reviewed? Well, remember earlier in our discussion, we talked about the fact that detention reviews typically happen every 30 days. And so if you're going to make an application for a judicial review, you're not necessarily going to have the court review that decision within 30 days. And so there really is no practical incentive for people to judicially review decisions, and Immigration Division members were never held to account for the procedurally unfair decisions that they were making. And so it was kind of a vicious cycle. Every 30 days, people would appear in front of a tribunal, but you know, seemingly bad decisions were being made. And this external audit conducted by the IRB was provided a window in which many of us who practice immigration law knew about, but couldn't articulate or had the evidence, so to speak, to show people that this was a systemic problem. So I provide this context because I think it's really important to say that if you are in relying on a legislative scheme through an administrative body, but there are problems with that, or there are systemic issues with that, or there are particularities of that system that might not be beneficial or advantageous to your client, it's sometimes better to access other kinds of remedies. And in this case, if you are detaining someone, what better way to access a remedy than one that is found in the Constitution, right? So in the Charter. So I think it is extremely important that the court, I think, was alive to that, and that it recognized that there needed to be this kind of safety mechanism, and recognized that there wasn't a foolproof scheme laid out in the IRPA for immigration detainees. Having said that, you know, I think it's really important to also recognize that Justice Abella provided a dissenting opinion in Chena. And I think it's a very interesting dissent because I think in some ways she's right. Her dissent basically said that, you know, the IRPA does have a comprehensive scheme. She said if it was applied properly, if the IRPA was interpreted in a way that guaranteed the fullest possible range of scrutiny for detention, then, you know, there shouldn't be a need for habeas corpus. You know, and I think a lot of advocates and lawyers like myself agree that the IRPA definitely can be interpreted in a way in which a better review system can be put in place. And, you know, credit to the Immigration and Refugee Board, they are currently and have been since the external audit was released, been working to try to, you know, change the culture and the system under which immigration detention reviews are being conducted and are trying to remedy the situation. But, you know, until a full, you know, even under the circumstances of under which a perfect system is provided, I still think, you know, that the court was right, that there should be an availability of habeas corpus, one of the oldest writs out there, to ensure that people are not detained unlawfully.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Appointed. As always, please subscribe to the podcast and rate us on iTunes. Have some thoughts or feedback about the podcast? Tweet us at @appointedpod. Until next time.